Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it.
Yes. Yes, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we have a special guest today that's what I saw called Calling from Behind the Walls, and so we'll get to him in a minute, but this is a time when I remind you that we are connecting the voices on the battlefield, whether they be in the prison industrial complex, around healthcare, around education, but what you will see is that these issues are connected. Sometimes the folks who are on the battlefield feel isolated, but you know, then you get to see that people are fighting the same battles in different parts of the country, but also different parts of the world. So I always like to bring that into focus so that we don't feel isolated and we see how powerful we really are. So I also like to remind you that this is a time when to be reminded that we still have a pathological liar in the White House, a 34 count felon, a twice impeached president, who now, as far as I'm concerned and many other folks, is not only a national threat, but he is an international threat. And so we still have genocide in Gaza. We still don't have justice for the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. And we are still on the verge of being complicit in the war against Iran. And so all of that to say that this is all being done in our name with our money. And I want to say that because hopefully that enrages you that all of this is happening, including the destruction of the White House lawn and building and all of that that goes with it, all in our name, all in our name. So trillions of dollars are going out the window to do these vanity projects for Trump and to make his family rich, richer, and to the detriment of working class people. So there you have it. So we're going to talk about some of the ways you can get involved. People are resisting, they're organizing, and that's all good. Today we have a particular case, and you know we've done cases of injustice with the prison industrial complex, but you know there's always one that I think needs a little more spotlight, and it is the case of James Scott. And so we have today two people who have been advocates of his case. We have Kanika Harper, who's with an organization, and we'll hear about her, and we also have Adam. I thought we had Adam. Adam disappeared, but we're going to get Adam back. And do we still have James? Because I'm fearful if we don't have Adam, we don't have James. So, Adam, are you still there? Okay. So what we're going to do, we're going to keep this show going, and we're going to hear from Kanika Harper, who's with an organization, Missourians for All. Missouri for All. And so, Kanika, talk a little bit about your organization and then specifically how you came across James Scott's case.
Thank you, Jamala. Yes, I'm Kanika Harper with Justice for All. We are a Missouri-based organization that helps individuals and their families in various ways who are unjustly done by our criminal justice system. James came across our desk a few years ago via other incarcerated individuals, just honestly spreading the light on his case because of the injustice that he has received from Missouri. And then a colleague linked up with the videographer who's doing a documentary on James. They've done one once before, and I believe they're doing one at this current moment. And that's how we came about meeting Adam, and Adam has been along this journey with James for 30 years now. Can you hear me? Okay,
Yes,
yeah.
I can.
Okay. Yeah, Adam has been on this journey with James for 30 years. So these injustices, they look differently, but they act the same.
And I would say also that the same elements are usually involved where you have prosecutorial misconduct, you have inadequate defense attorney, you have, police informants or jail informants. So those elements seem to be common themes throughout wrongful convictions. And so those need to be lifted up because oftentimes people wonder, well, how did these people get to this place? And it's a whole system. And systems that are up against, they're up against, which makes it extremely difficult to come out of there. Because I can tell you, the James Scotts, the Ellen Reasonovers, the Daryl Burtons, they got out, but there are many, many still languishing inside not just Missouri prisons, but all across the country, who are wrong, who've been wrongfully convicted, but who haven't the resources or the attention they needed to get out of there. And so I always need to say that because sometimes people, Kanika will say, oh, everybody says they're innocent. No, they don't. If you do this work, you know that people don't normally say that unless it's true. Because they already know that people know. In the streets,
Right.
people know. And so there's no sense of you telling that lie and trying to get some attention. So my experience has been that people who do the wrong will admit it. Now, sometimes they will admit that the sentence was harsher than it needed to have been, and we know that just from the racism in the system that that's probably true. But they don't not say they did it. They say I did it, and I'm responsible. I'm remorseful. But sometimes that doesn't make a difference in the scheme of things.
Absolutely. So primarily we work with people who are wrongfully convicted over sentence. Also, we do a lot with the juvenile justice system and reform, things of that nature. And it is, I can tell you, harder to get someone out of prison who is wrongfully convicted and didn't commit the crime than it is to get someone out who did.
Isn't that
So
something? What's wrong
yeah,
with
it
that
is.
picture? What is wrong with that picture?
I don't know if it's Missouri not writing, wanting to right wrongs. One second, let me try to get. I think
Really?
this is James.
Okay. Yeah, we had already, y'all, anticipated we might have some problems because
Oh,
when
and
you
it is
is
just hung up.
when you inside the system
Yeah.
trying to get access to a phone and get a clear line and all of that,
Absolutely.
Yeah, but we thought all the lucky stars came together just a minute ago before we went on air, and then all of a sudden, boom, we lost two people at the same time.
Yes, but it is very trying when it comes to even with the checkpoints of say probation and parole. I think the number seven thing on their checklist is admitting guilt, showing remorse, things like that. But if you have someone that is wrongfully convicted, admitting guilt will be a hurdle.
Right,
if they
exactly.
didn't commit the crime. So that hinders a lot, and there's all these barricades to further oppress people who didn't commit the crimes that they are convicted of.
Well, one of the things that the Organization for Black Struggle, having worked with wrongful convictions and worked with particular prosecutors, one of the things I've told them both publicly and said privately is that you all are coming to an office that, yes, we want you to be reformers going forward, but y'all got some ugly history that has to be taken care of. So you can't go forward without first acknowledging there's been harm done by this your office. And sometimes they don't want to go backwards because they say that was under somebody else's watch. I can only do what I, you know, what I, no, you know, it's, that's not the way it works. And so we are still working on cases under the fairly new prosecutor. And as you said, it's really hard because unless you have a really cut and dry case, they don't want to touch it because they are fearful that if they, I guess, exonerate somebody and they turn out to be, not innocent, then that's a problem for them. But everything is not always that cut and dry. I mean, sometimes you have emerging DNA that exonerates somebody. That's all good. Sometimes you have a witness that recants, or sometimes you have the perpetrator themselves said, "I did it." That is not always how these cases flow. And so sometimes when you have a case like we're working on one for Federico Lobe, and yeah, he doesn't have somebody recanting. In fact, the victim has now died. I mean, the case is so old, it's been in there close to 37 years. It's a rape case, it's not even a murder case, Kanika. And so, my thing is always like he's been in prison longer than some murderers have been in prison. So what do you think about that, Mr. Prosecutor or Miss Prosecutor? So yeah, so that's the nature of our current system, which sometimes people think it may be beyond reform, but in the meantime, in between time, you have to make those reforms where you can. And so, looking at the cases that you've been involved with, what do you think are the real hurdles in the prosecution's office that keeps people from not getting their case heard in court?
The second time or the first time around
The
when they.
well, both.
So we actually did an initiative, Single Citizens Voices Unheard, where we took a 10-year span and heard cases of individuals who are incarcerated currently that have actual claims of innocence. Some of them have irrefutable evidence of their innocence, yet they still sit behind these bars 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Without having their stories or their cases being reheard. Prosecutorial misconduct is a huge thing. There's a lot of the same prosecutors on a lot of these cases, same judges, things like that. And honestly, early 90s, things like that, the public defenders tanked a lot of these cases. They did not have adequate representation. That has been a huge thing, more so sometimes than prosecutorial misconduct, where they didn't have a defense. Cases where public defenders didn't file notice of alibi defense, so their defense wasn't heard at all. Cases where they didn't look at evidence that was not heard, but it was there that could have gotten them off, and showing their innocence. It's just across the board, things from police misconduct and abuse and witness intimidation and threats of harm or violence. Let me try this again. This is James coming through. I'm going to actually try it on the computer, see what we can do. No, I'll just do this.
An offender at the Jefferson City Correctional Center is called from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded to accept thank you for using Securus. You may start
I'm
the
going to hold the
conversation.
phone. Hello,
Okay,
James.
that.
James? Hey, James, hold on one second. Let me try to get you close to the microphone here. Okay. James, I'm on with Jamala right now.
And we are live.
And we are live. Can you say a few words to see if she can hear you at all? It's really low.
Now that's interesting because it was louder than that when he called the first time. Yeah.
Yeah. I can hear him wrestling with the cord.
Okay, voices fam, stay patient here. Let's see if we can get James on the phone where you could actually hear his story. So
Okay, James.
that's a little better.
Okay, let's just try to. I'm going to lean it up on the board. Okay, so James, we're on with Jamala, as I previously stated. Can you give her a quick introduction?
My name is James. I am currently incarcerated at the Jefferson City Correctional Center from Jefferson City, Missouri.
Okay.
So, James, I'm going to ask you to talk about your case, and know it goes back. But when I first heard about it, the first case I thought about was Dale Hamlick, and I don't know if you're familiar with that case, Kanika, but it's so similar. Dale was convicted of murdering his mother during the flood. Apparently, he tied his a concrete block to his mother and threw her in the raging floodwaters of the Osage Ridge River. Now, he admits he was no saint at the time. He was a bad boy. He was behind in his child support payments. And we had an aggressive prosecutor who thought he would be the prime example to make as he pursued his career, his upward career. And so that was none other than Kenny Hushoff, who was the lead prosecutor at the time. This man, Dale, can you imagine, first of all, knowing that your mother has been murdered, where you don't even have the chance to grieve? You are now the prime suspect and have to then deal with your own defense. To me, that's just double cruelty. So long story short, he was convicted. Luckily, he did not get the death penalty, which is, you know, Kenny was calling for that because that's how he made his mark on sort of, you know, crime, tough on crime. But he got 50 years without parole. For him, the luck is that he got enough support for his case, enough spotlight on there, enough resources that he was able to get that exonerated. But he served 15 years for a crime he didn't commit. So when I heard about the flood of 1993 with James, I couldn't help but think about Dale's case, his mother being murdered during that time. And of course, once these people, once the powers to be go for the wrong person, then the right person has escaped. And all the evidence is probably literally, in this case, been washed away. So James, tell us about your case, because it also happened during the big flood of 1993. And we might need Kanika to help be a translator for you. We can't hear you too well.
Okay. I've been incarcerated for almost 33 years for a crime. I haven't died. The threat of 1993 affected millions of people, in the Midwest for about 4 or 5 days leading up to the levee failure. I was a volunteer at the Western Levee. A friend of mine, his mom, regularly suggested it, instead of us boys, just hanging out, doing whatever, she recommended it or suggested that he go volunteer to that. Well, I took her funny. I did that. And I went to West Winter Levy. I volunteered there 4 or 5 days, maybe 6 days, throughout the course of the 12. I didn't work a lot of days, but I worked there, 4 or 5 days. And I remember one time, one night, my ex-wife and I, we went to try to throw sand bags, but the two places in were shut down for the night. But I volunteered on the West Coast, doing certain things, walking, patrolling, doing what I could. On July 16th, probably the time, mid-morning, me and the guy that I was walking with, he said, Bob, north of the Bayview Bridge. And we went to try to find somebody, and we found a guy that we thought was a person of authority. We went and talked to him, and we said, we got the problem, we need you to come look at it. We walked up there, and about halfway, 3/4 of the way up there, he stopped and said, my main concern is that my guy stopped the Bayview Bridge. But I'll let somebody know and have him come check it out. We don't know if he ever did. But about the levee failed on around 8:22 p.m. the West Coast levee failed. We don't know. I didn't know at the time if it failed at the exact spot that I know it's a problem or not. But after the levee failed, I helped the Coast Guard put boats in the water to go search. After that, I lost my key, in the process of helping the Coast Guard. So I had to have my car was towed to my parents' house. When I arrived at my parents' house, I was pulled aside by a woman called, or named Michelle McCormack. She was with WCEM there in Springfield, Illinois. They asked me for an interview. I gave her an interview, and basically described, what I seen, what I experienced. And not knowing at the time and there were police officers who watched that interview, and they're like, there's no way that James or Jimmy Scott was over there doing any kind of good, any kind of anything, being any kind of helpful. And the hunt for me began. They believe that, you know, because of my past, which is something I'm, and if I didn't have the problems I did as a kid growing up, I don't believe I would be in prison today. But, you know, the cops felt that I had no business being over there. And again, you know, the hunt for me began. Next, my car was towed to my parents' house. And I was.
But yeah, and it's raining cats and dogs here. But I'm thinking, though, at the point that they saw you and they had some history with you, they took it to the next level, obviously. But how could they have convinced a prosecutor to take a case where there was no there? Can you talk about a bit about that? I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, I know that dude's up to no good. What is he doing there helping with sandbags? Okay, yeah, that might be a observation that they had, but how could they convince a court to say this man is a murderer?
No one died during the, there's no fatalities or anything like that during the flood. So, and James's case, I tell him all the time, even in media, because I remember and was affected by the flood of 93 myself, it was a natural disaster. Yet James is in prison for over 30 years. How does a human being cause a natural disaster? I tell him all the time, I say, James, you are Missouri's best kept secret because no one knows you're in prison for causing the flood of 93.
I mean, I can't even think about anybody during Katrina, except for the folks who needed to be called out. And, you know, that was... the fact that the levees were old and had already been predicted at some point to break, but an individual that, you know, that's unheard of. So again, I'm, you know, what evidence did they produce to say,
it's
yes,
more political than it is anything. Cause a lot of people, recuperated off of it being from a person rather than a natural disaster.
And talk about that. Well, first of all, let's answer the question in terms of the evidence, because you got to go into the courtroom with something to get the jury to buy this story. Mm-hmm. You got to get 12 people convinced. And I don't, you know, maybe they weren't convinced totally, which is why, I don't know. It's just such a confounding kind of situation where you have an individual that's being accused of setting a levee off that causes a flood. First of all, that's pretty an amazing story. But how did you convince 12 people that happened? James, you were there. What happened?
Yeah, it took a trip that I made to the police, that I moved sandbags, which I actually did. I moved sandbags. Every when they think of the levee, they think, you know, it was sandbags. Everyone thinks of a levee, you know, being, you know, a sandbag levee or whatever. Every so often they had piles of sandbags, which were there to be used to shore up depressed areas or trouble spots. And I moved 4 or 5 sandbags from an area that was strategically placed there for that purpose. I moved sandbags from one area to a depressed area. And the sandbags that I moved were probably 40, 50 pounds a piece. So there they wasn't like. And I moved those sandbags to a depressed area, which I thought was a trouble spot. And there were experts that testified, and there are experts across the country who don't believe that moving 4 or 5 sandbags caused the levee to fail. And I told them, I said, if my actions caused the levee to fail, that was not my intention. But again, I don't believe my actions caused it to fail. You know, they took the statements from... Some neighborhood kids that were saying that, you know, Jimmy Scott said he wanted to break the levee, and they went as far as they are. They talked to one guy, Joe Flax. They spoke with Joe Flax in July of 1993. Joe Flax, with his mother present, said Jimmy Scott never broke the levee. He never told me he broke the levee. When I was granted a retrial due to prosecutorial misconduct, And in 1998, I went back for reprop. Well, preparing for my trial, they took a videotape deposition from this Joe Flax. And Joe Flax made the statement that Jimmy Scott broke the levee, Tony broke the levee. He took a shovel, dug in the side of the levee, fell on hands and knees, and bored the hole out, and the levee broke. Well, who'd you tell? I told these cops. What cops did you tell? And he mentioned Neil Baker, Dennis Bowden, and a Mel Gibson. Well, there's no Mel Gibson at the Quincy Police Department. It's Detective Robin Bell. Well, during my appeal process, my attorneys took depositions of all three of these police officers, and all three of them said, no, Joe Flax never told us anything about Jimmy Scott breaking the left. One cop went as far as calling Joe Flax the biggest death liar that I've ever met. But they used my statement that I gave to the police and used that statement, which was a lie, and other statements from other people to convict me. You know, we had an expert witness there, him. He testified for me at my trial, actually both trials, and he basically staked his career on my innocence. He said that there's no way that Jimmy Scott broke the levee, that it was natural causes and not an act of sabotage. This case has really left a sour taste in his mouth because he believed that, you know, the jury basically disregarded what he said. And what David Hammer does, you know, he's been, you know, in the business that he does right now, he's been doing this since the 60s. He was making topographical maps for the government, you know, when he was in the military. So he knows his stuff. And for him to step out on them and say, you know, stake his career on my innocence, that says a lot. But that's basically what they used to convince me. You know, we don't believe that there was evidence there, and there shouldn't have been nothing because, yeah, I shouldn't be here today. I should be home.
So, Jim, what I hear you saying is the so-called person who had the testimony that nailed you initially said you didn't do it, and then he came back some years later to say you did do it, which makes people like me and Kanika, who know this system and working with these cases, know that somewhere, somehow, the prosecutors got to this guy and say, we need you to do this. And if you don't, this could happen to you. So it seems like there was some intimidation that happened during that time for somebody to be very clear on what happened. 1 year, and then several years later, all of a sudden, they're very clear on a completely different story. So obviously, you lost the retrial, right?
Yeah, you know, when after my trial, you know, Adam Pizdek, he was prepared to do a story on my case. I remember walking up the stairs, you know, going in the two house back at the wall, the old prison had back at the wall. I turned around to Adam and said, "Find Joe Flax. He knows the truth." And he found him, and Joe Flax made a statement to the police. I mean, to Adam Pitlick, and if you pay me, I'll talk. Well, for one, that's not going to happen. That's unethical. And two, you know, I just want you to tell the truth. I want you to say, I can't prove that he was given some promise up to say what he said. But, you know, if something smells bad, you better look to make sure, see what it is, because, you know, we know he lied. You know, and I believe they denied me my right to confront him face to face because under the confrontation clause, you know, you either have to be dead, they can't find you, or you're incapacitated. And they knew where he was because he was in a work release center in Illinois, and they could have brought him to my trial, but they didn't do it because I believe they knew that he would have been found out. But I don't know. You know, my attorney was working in collusion with prosecutors because, you know, I don't know.
Wow. So, you know, if you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are here talking to James, a.k.a. Jimmy Scott, who's calling from Jefferson, I don't even call it correctional, Jefferson Prison, about his case, which is really a pretty phenomenal case where he was accused of unleashing the levees and starting the flooding of 1993. Also joining us is Kanika Harper, who's been working with this case as well as other wrongful conviction cases. And, you know, Jimmy's case has been highlighted some, and he's also been the subject of a documentary, and as Kanika talked earlier, a second documentary. So I'm wondering, with the increased publicity about the case, what is the prognosis for exoneration or freedom or overturning of the case? What do we know about that right now?
Well, after 30 plus years, James will be going up for his first parole hearing this month. In 30 plus years, Jimmy, if you want to speak a little bit about what's to come, you have the floor.
Nikki just said, no, I go in front of the parole board for the first time since my incarceration. My parole hearing was moved, as has been moved numerous times for whatever reason, but I'm finally getting the opportunity to go in front of the board. I have proclaimed my innocence since day one, and I know the board of probation and parole, they want to show remorse, you know, they want somebody to say I'm sorry, but I believe because of my stance, you know, I can't go up there and admit stuff that I haven't done or show any kind of remorse. You know, I do feel sorry for what people went through, what people lost during the 1993 flood, but as for me taking responsibility for something I haven't done, I can't do that, you know. And I'm fully aware, because of my stance, that they may never let me out since then. You know, I've had guys here say, you know, you need to go over and tell them you're sorry and show remorse, they'll let you go. And other guys here have told me, you can't do that. He said, you know, regardless of what these other people say, you know, you proclaim your innocence, you know, since the beginning. And if you go in front of the parole board and you say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, they're going to say, you know, one of them may ask me, well, are you lying then or are you lying now? Are you
right?
And saying, well, I can't do that, you know, and I won't do that.
So you based on staying true to your principles, Jim, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, it seems like to me that the criteria for getting parole needs to be changed, because what we found over the years, and Kanika can verify this, is that people who come are not all guilty. And so it seems to be no leverage, no, you know, for people who come with claims of innocence, because I'd be like you. I'm like, I'm not agreeing to nothing. I didn't do it. I didn't do it then. I didn't do it now. And I know you all are dangling this freedom in front of me, but I'm going to have to suck it up and continue my path of righteousness. So what can we expect? And is there anything the general public can do in terms of letters to the parole board or anything else to support you?
I know there is a Missouri statute that basically says defenders continue claiming.
I think his phone went out. We're going to see if it comes back on. Oh, hey, Jimmy, your phone went out for a second. We didn't hear you. Can you repeat that?
You were talking about the statute.
All right, the statute, okay. There is a Missouri statute specifically parole context that expressly lists defenders considered claim of innocence is something a board may consider, along with prison records, government adaptation, workable parole plan, and community report. Since my incarceration, I've received conduct violations. And matter of fact, Ms. Miranda Martin, she's one of the assistant wardens here, she did my first violation back in 2006. And she asked me, she said, how much did you pay? You know, you've been locked up all these years. My response to her was, I didn't break the law to come to prison. Like I said, I've had four violations. I have a good work record with staff. My job, I've worked in and around the same job since 1998. I have good work record, institutional record. My support with support and relationships with staff and inmates. I mean, there's nothing else I could possibly do besides what I've already done, but to continue doing what I'm doing. You know, I can't do more, like I said, than what I've already done. I'm well-liked and respected by everybody here. And a lot of people who know my case is kind of confusing because, they said, you just don't seem like that you're the person who should be in prison. Now, that being said, I take responsibility for, the dumb things that this kid, growing up. But I also take responsibility for the man I am today. I have self-rehabilitated myself. I've taken every class possible. I went through the year-long ITC program. Everything I could possibly do to better my situation, give me the tools, my toolbox to go home. If a situation happens to you, or if I'm in relief, I have those tools. I have a good relationship with support group, for when that day comes for me to be released. And I also have plans to work with Kanika, Dina, Sheena, and others, because the system here in Missouri is broken. It needs fixed. It needs overhauled. And I'm hoping to be a part of that. But first, I have to get out and go home.
So one of the things I know they always consider is, would you be a danger to yourself and others should you be released? And it sounds like, based on the work that you've done, the personal work that you've done, that would not be the case. So what is the exact date of the parole hearing, board hearing? And I'm going to ask this to you, Kanika, so we make sure we hear it loud and clear. Is it appropriate for folks to send letters on behalf of Jim regarding this case?
Absolutely. Letters to PNP. James also has an attorney that put together a parole packet as well. And that shows all of his accomplishments that he's acquired while being incarcerated, things of that nature. But letters of support.
Should they go directly to the attorney or to the parole board? If people want to write a letter and say this, even if they don't know specifically about the case, and I have to tell people this all the time, when people like me and Kanika work on these cases, we can't say unequivocally we know that this person is innocent. But what we are saying is that based on the evidence that we have and that person was convicted on, mm-hmm. we got some strong suspicions that was not the case. And we also know that the process by which they got there was unfair. And so even if you just say it seems like it was unfair, process of conviction, you don't have to say, I believe he's innocent if you don't believe that. But you need to talk about like the circumstances of the case. And also you just heard that James has done all he possibly can do to better himself. If you want to see the, this, many articles about his case, but also there's the documentary about the case where you actually can hear Jim in his own voice talk about what he's done. So if it goes to the board here, you can go online and get the address for that and try to appeal to the better judgment of these people about this case. Because after 30 years, come on, y'all, please.
I mean, at best, it would be a vandalism case. At best, 30 plus years, and this is your first time for a parole hearing. That is an injustice in itself. An injustice in itself. On top of, we know, I've personally seen the rate of wrongful convictions go up. At one point, it was 2% of people, then it was 9% of people. They're saying now it's upward of 10% of everyone that's incarcerated is in there unjustly, that they didn't commit the crime that they're convicted for. Well, it's 24,000 people in Missouri prisons alone. That is 2,400 people in prison for something that they didn't do.
And I know a large majority have written you for help, because they've written the Organization for Black Struggle. And for organizations like us, it's almost impossible other than to lift their voices in best we can. But the cost of retrying that and independent folks, like we work very closely with Centuria Ministries up from, it's a New York based, and our first case with them in 1999 was the Ellen Reasonover case. But those cases cost close to $500,000 to retry. And this is on the part of those nonprofits. This is not the Justice Department. I mean, the justice system going through this. You got to collect all that evidence and bring it to them and say, hey, here's what we found out. So now would you take a look at it and see what you find? Who's got those kind of resources, y'all? So this is why it's important to do all we can as everyday citizens who are paying taxes, who these people are being convicted in our name when we know the circumstances were unjust. And so we need you to just do a letter, handwritten if you need to, send it to the Board of Probation
and Parole,
and say, please give this man, you know, serious consideration. He's done all he can do for a crime that he didn't commit. And again, the crime, I'm trying to remember, what is the crime? Is it the crime destruction of public property? What was he convicted of?
It was hundreds of acres of land, property, homes, farmland, things of that nature, both in the Illinois and Missouri side that was affected by the Great Flood of 93.
So did they put a dollar amount on that to say, but what? it just seems so far-fetched. I'm just trying. I know my listeners are saying, what the? But yeah, so one of the things I think this does is Jim was helping, as many people did during the flood. You know, I can remember here in even St. Louis, people, you know, gathered where they needed to do the sandbagging to help neighbors helping neighbors. And to think that you could be accused of something because a rogue police recognized you in a TV interview, it's the kind of thing that makes people take a second thought of, first of all, helping, because I remember even in the Ellen Riesenhofer case where she came forward to say she saw some suspicious activity at the service station where she went to get change. And next thing you know, she's a suspect, and not only a suspect, but eventually gets arrested, convicted of a crime. So people are like, oh, that's why I ain't gonna get involved. No. You fight to make a system just so that you will never get convicted of a crime like that. That's what you do. You don't say, I'm not gonna help. I'm not gonna help, you know, do sandbagging. I'm not gonna help, like, report suspicious activity when somebody's been murdered at a service station. That shouldn't be the reaction. The reaction should be, if that happened to me, what kind of system do I want to have to go through that's going to find me innocent? So I just think that, you know, we all have an obligation to make these systems who are operating. All these people are being paid by us, y'all. These are public servants. You know, a prosecutor gets paid by us to make sure that there's a fair process and that the people who are guilty are really guilty. And if you make a mistake, which is there's human error, that you're going to work twice as hard to make sure that that person gets exonerated. And instead, and Kanika, you can speak to this, they work twice as hard to keep the truth from coming out, because should you find out that the system was wrong, and not just wrong, but intentionally wrong, where you manipulated evidence, hid evidence, destroyed evidence, the police, you know, intimidated witnesses, and then in some cases lied about what happened, then you actually have more of an obligation to make sure that those people get justice. And that's the part that we don't see as readily, I'm sad to say. James, do you want to say anything else about your case that people should know about that they may not know?
Well, you know, since my documentary came out in 2022, there's been a lot of information that has, you know, been uncovered pertaining to the West Western Navy, people associated with the West Western Navy. Up until about 4 or 5 years ago, the Corps of Engineers had no idea that I even existed in the Missouri Department of Corrections, you know, for the cause of levee failure. You know, they made a report, I think in August of 1993, and they reported that at the West Quincy Levee, the proper term that is the Pavius Levee District in West Quincy, Missouri, that the levee failed due to overtopping. There was a 1,081 levee broke due to, you know, during the 93 flood, and they convicted me of one of them. Again, the Corps of Engineers had no idea that there was a kind of lockdown in the state of Missouri for that levee failure. One of the, you know, the part of that prosecutor was I went to every break to like party, messed around on my then wife, and do some good fishing. Well, nothing broke July 63. Well, July 17th, her mom and I, my ex-wife Susie, her mom and I talked on numerous times trying to find her with her business, trying to get her home with me in Illinois. And we finally made a arrangement where I was going to pick her up. I was going to drive to Hamilton, Illinois, and her mom and dad was going to drive her to Kia from Iowa. And she was driving broad across to visit the city to Hamilton, Illinois, where I picked her up. So the motive was for me to train her over there so I could party, invest in her, and do all kinds of stuff. Well, she was home with me. That's 24 hours. That's the next sale. So that was crazy for her to walk, you know, that motive. There was, we didn't know that Norman Hare, he's the commissioner of the West Coast Study, that we had no idea until an investigative reporter or somebody from, somebody found a C-SPAN video from Norman Hare testifying in front of Congress in Washington, D.C. about the and we never knew that that existed. We never knew that. And Norman Hare even went to Washington, D.C. to talk to the Congress about the 93 flood. But I just gave it a comment that, you know, the Corps of Engineers, Corps of Engineers over a decade, you know, the Corps responsible for that levee failure. When I ran a retrial in 97, I went back to retrial in 98, and we had our 8th and they started cooking April 30th. On May 8th, this levee district, the Chesapeake Levee District, joined a class action lawsuit blaming the Corps of Engineers for what they had just found me guilty of. Up until about, we have no idea, you know, what the, you know, what happened to the lawsuit, what, you know, how they ruled or how they decided. But about 5 years ago, right before the documentary came out, Norm Hare said, I even made a comment, I never served, you know, to make, you know, about a day. Now, Norman Hare believes I've served my time, but, you know, I want to say this is funny, you know, but, you know, this is just something you can't make up. July 16th is Norman Hare's birthday. His daughter made him a cake or had a cake made for him, and they depicted a levee. In the levee, they show the levee on the cake, they show the levee breaking. So the cake actually, you know, it looked like it was breaking, and there was a barge coming through the break. Left. He gave him this cake on July 16th, sometime in the morning time, you know, between 8 and 12, somewhere around there. And the West Quincy levee broke about 8:22 p.m., and not one, two, but three barges come through the break. And whose property, who was the largest landowner in West Quincy, where did the levee break at? On his property. No, that's public knowledge. And he's been quickly awake on July 18th, the Sunday paper, July 18th. So, you know, that's something that's kind of weird. If you're going to give your dad a cake and the levee breaks, there's a barge coming through, the levee breaks that night, and the barge comes through the break. You can't make that up.
So you can't make it up, but also for our listeners, in terms of just being more analytical, is there's always a story behind the story. Who's going to benefit from James Scott being convicted of this so-called crime? And then when you start to follow the money, you come to the real culprit. And so somebody's got to be made the scapegoat. And if it's a poor working class black person, a poor working class white person, Latina, it doesn't make any difference. This is a sacrifice that's going to be made so I can either advance my career, get some money. Somewhere in there is benefiting somebody who is victim, who's going to use the system to victimize a person who is the most vulnerable to the system. And so, you know, I think that, and this is the thing that people have a hard time with reconciling. How could somebody do that and know that they have somebody in prison for something that they helped to create the whole scenario around? And that goes even for somebody who willingly or who knowingly knows that there's somebody in prison serving time for what they did. Those are real those are real sociopaths, the way that I look at it. I did the crime, and I'm watching on the news, some poor soul is getting ready to take the hit for what I did, and I don't see nothing wrong with that. You know, it is what it is kind of thing. Now, sometimes the people over time, the guilt gets to them and they confess. But you know, we got folks who we've raised as sociopaths, and so the empathy is not there. And so their thing is somebody would have done it to me, so I'm gonna do it to somebody else. And yeah, that's the sad state of affairs. But we the people have the obligation and the responsibility of making this system just for anybody who has to go through it, whether they are guilty or not. And some people say, I'm guilty, I'll take the lesser sentence, whatever. But there's people who are not. And Kanika, I think it's more than the 10%. You know,
just the ones that
we know about.
They don't count those heads that are still in prison screaming, hey, I have this evidence. They're counting the ones that they actually bring home nationally.
Right. And I would say, Kanika, there's also many who have just given up to say, nobody's listening, nobody's going to do anything, so I'm just stuck. I'm going to do the time. Those people have just been beat down, and they're not going to make a lot of noise. They've accepted their fate, which is an unjust fate. But nevertheless, they figure the hurdles are too high to climb for me to get the attention I need. I don't have resources for an attorney. My family, you know, can't help me. They're struggling out there on their own, so I'm just gonna accept my fate, which is really sad. I think it's the saddest part of the story about the unjust criminal justice system,
which will increase the. I mean, you gotta look at it. If 10% of planes fell out of the sky, would you go to the airport to take a flight? If one out of 10 planes was gonna hit the ground,
that's
an enormous number.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's a lot. I want you to go over again. This is the last thing, because I always try to give people an assignment. Your assignment is, Kanika, tell them their assignment with the parole board.
If you could write to the parole board, we have 7 people on Missouri's parole board. Write to the parole board. The address is online, is Missouri's PNP. And advocate for support for James Scott. He is located at the Jefferson City Correctional Center. Jimmy, can you give them your inmate ID number? One more time, that was a little muffled.
100-1364.
Okay, his inmate ID number is 100-1364. He's located at the Jefferson City Correctional Center, also known as JCCC. Just in a letter of support for his release. His parole hearing is going to be this month, July 22nd. I don't believe we have a time yet, do we, Jimmy? No.
No, can you first or last or
yeah.
They say it's gonna happen.
It'll be throughout the day sometime on the 22nd of this month. So there's still time to email, write a letter, or even just simply give him a call.
And we hope that you will, because that's very little effort, considering this man has been incarcerated for 30 years. That's the least we could do, is to pick up a pen or a typewriter and type out something, slap a stamp on there, and get it to the parole board on his behalf. Because wouldn't it feel really good for you to be a part of this man being released after July 22nd.
And we're so just that's aesthetic that he's actually getting a date, because his parole hearing over the 30 plus years has been pushed off.
And somebody's helping to push it off. And so we got to push back, y'all. Somebody's making sure he doesn't get that parole hearing. We need to say he deserves that hearing, and here's why. And this man needs to be freed immediately. Thank you, Jimmy, for taking time out. Kanika Harper with Missouri for All, thank you for joining us. We got a lot to do, y'all. You can see we got battles on all kind of fronts. Next week, we are going to have my friend Kika Matos, who is now the head of the National Immigration Law Center, who's going to talk about what's happening with, you know, immigration and citizenship, particularly with Haitians. This is another battlefront, y'all, that we need to be mindful of. And we also, for Coming up on Sunday, I believe, is the Mill Creek play is going to happen. This is the culmination of the Mill Creek exhibit at the museum, History Museum. So if you haven't seen that, you need to get there. Go there at the same time that the play is, and that's going to be up on my website. So that's what's coming up. All of this you can see on my website, JamalaRogers.com. If you forget anything, if you want to hear another program that you missed, that's the place to go. So, again, thank you to my guest today.
Africans at home.
Oh, that's the wrong thing. My music is squared up again, but thank you for joining us. This is Jamala Rogers, and I will see you on the battlefield. Thank you for listening.
Right now.